is a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we not just give people another piece of our mind, but how do we actually give people the peace of the mind of Christ? How do we do that? Well, first of all, we have to have the mind of Christ on the matters of the day, which means we need to have saturated our lives in the scriptures. So if you haven't spent time today in the Word, let me encourage you to do that before you try to go and speak on behalf of God in the context of cultural conversations today. If you want some help with that, visit us online. We've got resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can always go to Facebook and like us there. We post there every day, and I post frequently on Twitter. So if you want to interact with me, that's the best place to do it. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right. I was tempted to make today fun for all Friday because there was just this litany of stories today that were humorous and fun and funny. So I'm going to start with a few of those. And then, of course, not everything is funny and the world is serious. And so we'll do some serious headlines as well. But if you haven't seen it yet, at some point you are going to have to check out this video. It's a BBC interview, very serious BBC interview of a professor. His name is Robert Kelly. And he's obviously sitting in his study, which we quickly find out is his home study, because even though he is sitting, you know, in his very British way, a very straight up and down and proper in front of the camera. Behind him is a door to the hallway, and he tries to keep his cool during this interview about a very serious subject, the South Korean politics and the removal of the president of South Korea, which we're going to talk about later in the show, when his two children interrupt. So live on the air on BBC World News, Professor Kelly's daughter, first of all, in a yellow sweater, little pigtails, her little glasses on, she toddles into the room. She can't be more than three. I'm guessing maybe the upper end of two. And she comes all the way to the desk where he's obviously talking live on a webcam of some kind. Well, she's then followed by a baby in, you know, what would you call that? Like a little rambler thing, like a little, you know, it's a thing with wheels, but a baby sits in it, a baby who can't quite walk yet, like a little walker thing. Okay, it is hilarious because then you see seconds later sliding through the door his wife, who tries to pull the 2.5, 3-year-old, you know, by the arm, and in so doing, pulls books off of the desk, and there's this crashing sound. And meanwhile, Professor Kelly never looks away from the screen. He does close his eyes for a moment. He does apologize in a very, you know, in a very British way, smiles and apologizes for the interruption. But the video, literally, you have to go and watch it because it's life. It's real life. This is what happens in real life, right? Kids interrupt us. Kids come into settings where they're not supposed to be. Kids do things they're not supposed to do. And bless her heart, my heart absolutely goes out to Mrs. Kelly, who I am sure, you know, full well intended to keep those two babies out of that room during this all-important BBC interview of her professor husband about such an important matter as South Korean politics. So there you go. It was a humorous reminder that, you know what? Children are no respecter of the news, and they are no respecter of the things that we think are so important in life. Because you know what? They're just fascinated by the fact that dad's on TV. Or dad's talking to somebody and I can't see who he's talking to and I want to go see. Maybe it's a Facebook thing. Maybe it's like when we talk to grandma. Let me go see. So she just comes right in. And following right behind her, very obediently, as little kids often do to their older siblings, here then comes the little one in the little walker thing. It's just, it's precious. The whole thing is great. So encourage you to get a good laugh. I don't even know. The video is just completely viral. Everybody is posting it and reposting it, so it's not hard to find. BBC interviewee interrupted by children. So my next thing is, my next fun for all Friday is that a monastery has adopted a homeless dog, and that homeless dog, he's a schnauzer, by the way, he is now Friar Moustache. So Friar Moustache, if you want to see maybe the cutest thing I've seen in a while, the St. Francis Monastery in Bolivia was named after a patron saint of dogs. So it makes sense that one of their newest members happens to be a stray dog that they rescued off the streets. They have named him Friar, it translates to Friar Moustache, and I'm not going to try to pronounce it in Spanish. So this lucky pup has his own habit, which means a little outfit that's brown that matches the monks, and he has monk duties, but he is free to roam the monastery. The pictures of Friar Moustache will certainly make you want to adopt a dog this weekend. That's all I have to say about that, but it is a great little feel-good Friday story. All right, here is not such a feel-good story, or it certainly would not have felt good to the person experiencing it. You're familiar with the Liar, Liar, Pants on Fire? Okay, well, this is Lawyer, Lawyer, Pants on Fire. All right, so Lawyer, Lawyer, Pants on Fire. Here's what happened. I know that this seems like a setup for a bad joke, but literally this lawyer's pants caught on fire in court in the middle of an arson trial. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Okay, so here we go. On Wednesday, Stephen Gutierrez, a Florida defense attorney, is in court, and his pants began smoking during an arson trial at the 11th. And so this is happening in Miami-Dade County. He was defending a 49-year-old man who was accused of setting his car on fire. And during his closing argument, Gutierrez began to feel heat coming from his pocket, where he had several electronic cigarette batteries. So his pants literally caught on fire. He says it was not staged. No one thinks that a battery that you've left in your pocket is somehow going to explode. After careful research, I now know that it can happen. He doesn't know it just by research. I mean, he knows it by his own experience. He says, I'm apparently not the only person this has happened to, but I am now in a position to shed light on the situation. So I would imagine that the maker of the e-cigarette battery is going to find itself probably in some sort of consumer product court after lighting an attorney on fire in the middle of an arson trial. But again, you can't make this stuff up. All right, my final funny Friday for you, or fun for all Friday, is about a best-selling book on Amazon. So it's a 266-page book. It is entitled Reasons to Vote for Democrats. It has a very catchy cover. It's got a donkey who's, you know, superimposed with an American flag. He's really a cute donkey. Ben Shapiro gives it a shout out on the cover and says it's thorough. It's a comprehensive guide to reasons to vote for Democrats. It's by Michael Knowles, and it's 266 pages of blank paper. Blank paper. So here's some of the comments of the reviews on the Amazon page where customers have reviewed this. Now remember, this is listed as an Amazon number one best-selling book. All right, so this is an Amazon bestseller, and here are some of the accolades given to the author of the book. If this is a phenomenal piece of literature, Knowles really captures the heart of the reader with his background, and he says it's a must-read for all Americans, including liberals. The next person says, this is just an incredible work. It's an insight into the modern progressive mind. It's going to leave you speechless. I've borrowed a copy from my neighbor's husband. It's so great. I haven't given it back yet. Anyway, it just goes on and on. It's quite silly. It's quite funny. And obviously, the whole thing is a joke. But I got to tell you, being a person who just finished a manuscript for a book that, you know, it took me no small measure of time to do. The idea that I could have just presented the world with 266 blank pages and a clever cover, you know, I got to tell you, I'm a little mystified, but it is a Friday funny, and I lift it up to you today. All right, friends, we're going to turn aside now from Friday funnies to some very serious news. We've got some serious news to deal with today. By now, you are aware that the president of South Korea is no longer the president of South Korea. Here to talk with us about this major international development is a person who's been on the show before to talk about his book, Soul Man. It's Frank Ahrens, and he is the former vice president of Hyundai, which is a company based in Seoul, South Korea. He's now the vice president at BGR Public Relations in Washington, D.C. You can follow him on Twitter at A-H-R-E-N-S, and then the letter F for Frank. You can find him online at frankahrens.com. Frank, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Hi, Carmen. Thanks for having me back, and hi to your listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
All right, so tell us what's going on in South Korea and why it matters to us.
Well, quite simply, the president there, Park Geun-hye, a first woman president of this very young democracy, it's been a democracy only since 1987, was impeached. And it works the way there is sort of the way it does here. Here in the U.S., the House impeaches and the Senate votes up or down on the House's impeachment. There they have a unicameral parliament who impeached President Park on charges of corruption and being at the head of this very strange, wide-ranging influence-peddling scandal in December. And then just last night, our time, the Constitutional Court there upheld that impeachment. So she is out. Korea is without, has only an acting president, and they have to hold an election within 60 days to elect a new president. Now, why does it matter? Because Korea is America's greatest ally in that part of the world. We fought a war together. The bond between these two countries is extraordinary. And South Korea has been the tip of the spear against North Korea. And North Korea at this moment, I would argue, is more dangerous than it has ever been. They have more war-making capacity and apparently the will to do so than they have ever had in the past. And because there has been a power vacuum in South Korea, Japan has really become ascendant. You saw that their Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visited new President Donald Trump 5 minutes after he was elected, and he came over for a big visit again. And so South Korea is in danger of falling off the map here in terms of Washington and the U.S. So this is a perilous time for the country. Now, that being said, the constitutional process worked there. They had millions of people demonstrating for her ouster. They were peaceful. They picked up the garbage when they left. It was an extraordinary display of civic behavior. But right now, the country has to move on.
Okay, so you have you've reminded us that this is a young democracy. I mean, 1987 is just not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about her, because she has, I know that she's no longer the president, but she's kind of a unique individual in terms of her own story. And so I know that part of the motivation of my listeners is that they're going to want to pray for her. Mm-hmm. So if you could give them a little sense of who this is and the challenges that she's already faced in her life, and now this is added to them.
Absolutely. So there's some good context for your listeners here. She is the daughter of a military dictator named Park Chung-hee, who took over the country in a military coup in 1961 and ruled it until 1979 as a military dictatorship. He put the country with its industrialization on the path to what it is now, a modern industrial economy. However, he was a brutal dictator. And when Park Geun-hye was 22, an assassin tried to kill her father, missed, and killed her mother. 5 years later, the dictator was killed by his own head of security. So by the time she was 27 or so, she was an orphan. She was estranged from her brothers and sisters. She never married, and she always said that she was married to Korea. The problem is she had come under the influence of this shamanistic cult leader who sprang up to power under her father, the dictator, and had received a lot of government favors. And it was he proclaimed himself a modern Jesus Christ. The shamanism has a long history in South Korea with superstition and so forth, and it merges with our forms of Protestantism and Catholicism, Christianity, to create these hybrid cults. And the shaman's daughter was about the same age as the President Park Geun-hye and became her friend. And the root of the current scandal was the president allowed herself to be manipulated by this daughter of the cult leader, and she effectively ran a shadow government. She was making a lot of the big decisions we thought the president was making, and now she's in jail and probably be in jail for a long time. So, yes, Park Geun-hye exercised very bad judgment. She placed her country in a very bad position, in a power vacuum, but at the same time, she has had a bizarre and tragic life, and she does deserve prayers.
All right, again, we're talking with Frank Ahrens, and Frank, it occurs to me that during our interview, we do not run the same risk as the expert on South Korea that was interviewed by the BBC when his kids came in. And if you haven't seen the video yet, I highly recommend it because you will get a good laugh about the whole thing. So tell us, there's a lot of characters who now might become president, and they're not all sort of equally friendly in terms of an American perspective. And some of them have, probably going to cozy up to North Korea, which we would not like to see. So kind of walk us through who you think maybe the top candidates for the job are. And South Korea normally takes a very long period of time to elect a president. In this case, they have to do it in 60 days. So speak to those two concerns.
Sure. So leading in the polls is a man named Moon Jae-in. He barely lost to President Park Geun-hye 5 years ago. He is a mainstream liberal. He is probably the equivalent of a Hillary Clinton, I would say. But to his left, I think second or third in the polls, is a man who is a self-described Bernie Sanders of South Korea. And most likely, the way it worked here is Moon Jae-in will get elected, but he will be forced to accept some of the more radical left-wing ideals to appease the faction that likes the Bernie Sanders of Korea, much like Hillary Clinton had to do here with Bernie Sanders. What does that mean for us? So, in the past, Park Geun-hye was a conservative president, which meant friendly with the U.S., tough on North Korea. Liberal presidencies in the past in South Korea have been much more friendly to North Korea in terms of what we would call appeasement, and they would call it getting along. A president very famously in the 90s had something called the Sunshine Policy, where he won a Nobel Peace Prize for holding a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, only to find out later that South Korea had actually paid some cash and bribed Kim Jong-il to get to the negotiating table, which just goes to show you it's what happens if you try to make nice with bullies, they'll simply take advantage of you. And so, but times are different now. Kim Jong-il, though he was a tough leader of North Korea and a brutal dictator, was not threatening to launch nuclear ICBM at America. And so if history is any judge, the next president of South Korea will be more liberal, will probably be friendlier toward China and Beijing, and a little less friendly toward the U.S. We could also see the beginning of a trade war between the two countries, because we know our President Trump doesn't like the trade deals that we've signed. He wants everything made in America, and he may slap trade tariffs on South Korea, which means your Hyundai and Kia and your Samsung washing machine and your LG flat screen will cost more, and South Korea will retaliate, which means it will be tough for a South Korean to buy a Ford, for instance, or an iPhone. So there could be definitely, I would look for an increase of rockier relations between our two countries, which have traditionally been almost like brothers.
All right, friends, we're talking with Frank Ahrens. He is the author of Soul Man, spelled like Seoul, South Korea. And it's actually a memoir of cars, culture, crisis, and the unexpected hilarity inside a Korean corporate titan. But one of the things you do in the book, Frank, that I think is helpful for people entering into this conversation today, because South Korea, frankly, does not pop to the top of our news feed every day, but it's at the top today, and people now have an interest in it culturally. And one of the things that you do so effectively in the book is help us kind of experience the South Korean culture from an American perspective. And so if folks want a look into and a feel for the South Korean culture, Soul Man is a great entry point into that, and it's just a fun read as well. Frank, anything else that you think we need to know before we go today?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. But we are going to see a shift of what's going on in East Asia. And, North Korea is – I just can't overstress this. I mean, we've always sort of gotten used to North Korea being a little bellicose. But to me, this time feels different. They feel actually very dangerous, not only to the theater, but to the broader world. And it feels like something will be coming to a head at some point soon.
All right, bad actors. South Korea has been our friend over time in a fairly unstable neighborhood, this is interesting times that we live in. I would say that this is not the only part of the world where it seems as if leadership is in flux. And so, thank you for your insights into what's happening in South Korea, and thank you for Soul Man. You guys can follow Frank online at Frank Ahrens. That's AHRENS.com. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and best of luck on your book.
Thank you. All right, friends, there's something going on in Texas that I don't want you to miss. Texas is actually looking at some legislation related to transgender bathrooms or the use of bathrooms by people whose sexual identity currently does not align with their biological sex. And so I bring you Senate Bill 6. It was proposed in January. It would not only require everyone in Texas to use bathrooms in public schools, government buildings, and public universities based on their biological sex, but it would also preempt local non-discrimination ordinances that currently allow transgender people in Texas to use the bathroom that corresponds with their current gender identity. So that may not sound to you like something that's terribly controversial. It also might not sound to you like something that people who purport to be Christians would be weighing in on using the Bible to actually advocate for LGBTQ concerns. But that's exactly what's going on. And so I lift this up to you today from the Christian Post. There is a pastor from the Agape Metropolitan Community Church in Fort Worth, Texas, who, alongside many other LGBTQ advocates, were protesting the bill at the state capitol in Austin. But what this pastor said is what I want you to hear, and then I want us to talk about how it is that we respond to this kind of language. He said this: "In the beginning, God created humankind in God's image. So God is transgender. We're all created in the image of what is holy, divine, and sacred, and we should all be treated that way." All right, let's just stop right there, and let's dissect that sentence, and let's take that apart. First of all, God indeed, in the beginning, created humankind in his image. Male and female, he created them distinctly, on purpose, and for a purpose. And that purpose is not only procreation, but the stewardship of the earth, the management of everything else which God has made. To use that and twist it to suggest that because God made human beings both male and female, distinctly so, in his image, to twist that and to suggest then that God is therefore transgender is, there's no other word for it, it's a bastardization of the Bible. Okay, this is twisting the scriptures in a way that, well, frankly, only the enemy normally does. Okay, so just because a person is using the Bible, please do not be fooled by the way in which it is being used. You will remember that when Jesus was tempted after 40 days of fasting in the wilderness and he had this direct encounter with the enemy of God, we know him as Satan or the devil, He used scripture too. So just because a person can quote the Bible does not mean that what they're saying aligns with God's will or what God meant by what God has said in the Bible. So he went on to say, we're going to stop using God as an excuse to hate people. Well, here's the reality. He's trying to get those who are opposing his view, this pastor, he's trying to get those opposing his view to give up by calling them bigots, by charging them with hate. We absolutely must come up with talking points in response that are measured and non-defensive. We need to be able to find a common ground for conversation. And certainly, when this pastor appeals to Genesis 1, my encouragement to you would be simply walk that out. What happened in Genesis 3? Why are we no longer conformed to the perfection of God's creation? All right, we've got resources posted for you today on this specific issue. And we talked with Owen Strand about this earlier on the Reconnect, so grab it, reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll be right back. Carmen LaVerge, and this is The Reconnect, where we are putting God in his place and living like we're loved and acknowledging that we are indeed set free. Hey, we're trying to get God back in the middle of every conversation, so that means that we want to be talking about what people are talking about, but we also want to be talking with people who know what's going on out there in the world, and one of those people is David Kenneman. Now, my first personal experience with David was at a Christian Leadership Alliance event where he came in to talk to CEOs of national ministries, and what we now know as the book You Lost Me, he was talking about before the book was out. And I got to tell you, I was absolutely captivated by the information that he was presenting at that time, and continue to rely not only on the book You Lost Me, but the follow-up Unchristian and then Good Faith in terms of understanding what is going on in the hearts and minds of people in our country who we all long to seek to reach with the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So David Kenneman is the president of the Barna Group, a research and communications company that works with churches, nonprofits, businesses, ranging from film studios to financial services. Since 1995, he's been directing interviews with nearly a million people. He's overseen hundreds of U.S. and global research studies, and he just released, or Barna just released, we'll give David all the credit here, just released a very large study called The State of Pastors, How Today's Faith Leaders Are Navigating Life and Leadership in an Age of Complexity. This study represents 320,000 church leaders. He's David Kenneman. You can follow him at David Kenneman on Twitter, and you can get the information we're talking about today at Barna.com. David, welcome to The Reconnect.
Hey, thanks for having me, Carmen. That's very kind of you to say all the nice things, and for giving me all the credit, too. That's what I really want.
Exactly. That's what I'm here for, man. Okay, yeah. So in the introduction of the survey book, you write this. Christian community in North America doesn't need stronger leaders. We need more resilient leaders. What do you mean by that?
Well, this notion of being incredibly strong and almost this pretense of having it all figured out is one of the areas where I think today's pastors are really struggling. We tend to put on the pedestal these leaders who seem to have it all together, and many of them do have many things together. But what we find in the research is that what today's people are looking for is resilience. They're looking for people who can face tough winds and actually become stronger in it. You know, that's sort of the picture of exercise, where the more resistance you lift or the more you run, you're actually conditioning yourself for for competing in a challenging circumstance or whatever. And so that's really what we were looking for with this research. We actually discovered that pastors may not be always focusing on resilience. They're so focused on getting everything right that they might be wound too tight. And we think this idea of resilience, how do we get stronger in the face of adversity, is one of the key themes of spiritual leadership today.
So when I read that word and when I interacted with this material, it brought to mind this conversation that I had once with somebody who was in recovery. And the image that they offered me about their own experience was that they had been living as if they were an egg. And, you know, trying to keep it all together and, you know, the white and the yolk separated and everything inside the shell. But when adversity came, you know, the egg only gets one shot. Like, it's once it falls and it's Humpty Dumpty and you can't put it back together again. And then he said, what I'm learning is how to be a tennis ball. You know, instead of being an egg, I'm learning how to be a tennis ball. This ability to bounce back. And the harder you get hit, then even the with more strength, you bounce back from that. So when I read that word resilience and sort of this, that's the image that came to mind. We really want people who aren't eggs. We really want people who are tennis balls.
Yeah, that's a cool image. I might use it in the future. And, you know, I think there was this fantastic book called Team of Teams written by General McChrystal that I really enjoyed. It became one of the real themes as we interpreted this research. And he's talking a lot about resilience in structures and resilience when we face a culture of complexity as parents, as pastors, as Christians. You know, we can try to hold everything together just like that egg and realize that just, you know, any small shaking of that circumstance, you almost feel like you've lost it, and yet we need to be able to be resilient in the face of it. Another image that this General McChrystal uses in his book is, you know, the pyramids in Egypt are incredibly robust; they're incredibly strong, but they could be destroyed with an atomic bomb. Right? They're completely robust, but they're immovable. Whereas if you look at forests or other natural phenomena, you know, they can be wiped out by natural plagues. They can face extreme adversity of temperature change and other things, but they bounce back. And I think that's what is so necessary for today's Christians. And then when we look at pastors, we need people who can bounce back, who can be resilient even in the face of great, great complexity and great, great adversity.
Well, and we have so much to learn from Christians who experience real persecution around the world. So, you know, I'm wondering if there's a layer of this where there are models out there of resilient pastoral leadership that we could look at.
Well, we found a lot of it in the research, actually. So, you know, first, people who are part of the overall headline of the study is that pastors in America are doing pretty well. You know, we interviewed over 10,000 pastors for this study over the course of many years, and in a lot of ways, they are being very resilient. What's interesting, for example, is that sometimes pastors who make less money are actually more satisfied with their work than those that make more money. And it's not to say that we shouldn't make more money in any kind of ministry, but it's an interesting thing. It's like money isn't a direct correlation with being satisfied with your work in ministry. We find that younger pastors are in some ways more resilient for the fact that they've got this whole life ahead of them, and they're very energized by their ministry. We find a whole different range of things that people who have strong spiritual practices, for example, they're praying and they're reading their scripture as a pastor, not just for the sake of their job, but we found a strong correlation between their resilience in ministry based on the amount and health of their own spiritual practices, which makes sense, but we found a lot of proof of that. And we found a lot of proof of the resilience of people that have great friendships in ministry. So not just people in your church who you say, yeah, I'm friends with those people, but really deep friendships and a relational structure that supports you in ministry. And so that's really what we went through and found ample evidence. It's just a few of the examples. There's dozens of them throughout the project of correlations with resilient leadership. And so how can we self-assess? Are we resilient? In what ways are we resilient? In what ways are we not resilient? And are there things that we need to be putting in place to develop an even better resilient structure in our lives?
So, friends, we're talking today with David Kenneman from Barna. You can find the information that we're talking about at barna.com. The study is The State of Pastors, How Today's Faith Leaders Are Navigating Life and Leadership in an Age of Complexity. Hey, let's talk about burnout. Let's talk about on the other end of we got all these pastors that are doing really well, and I'm thrilled to learn that and hear that. I also have a level of concern for the level of burnout. There's at least, you know, like rumors out there that, you know, more than 1,000 pastors leave the pastorate every month. Is that true? And what does your research show about the correlation between burnout and any particular cause or practice?
Well, I think that notion of 1,000 pastors a month quitting is probably in the category of urban legend. Certainly there are too many pastors who are quitting, although, listen, if you're not called to it and if the Lord is moving you on, that's part of what we really learn, that resilience is really about faithfulness to God's call, not just about sticking it out despite every challenge that you face, or on the other hand, leaving. You know, some people are there's a right season for a pastor to leave ministry and to do something else. We actually see that related to one of the major findings of the study, which was that pastors are getting a lot older. The average age of today's pastors is 54 years, whereas 25 years ago it was 44 years was the average age. So, you know, there does seem to be maybe not a lot of resilience in passing on your work to the next generation. That's a lack of resilience in some cases. And then getting to this question of burnout, you know, we actually looked through three different lenses at burnout. One was burnout risk overall, and we had about 9 or 10 different statements that we used to measure that. It wasn't just, are you going to burn out, yes or no, but we had a whole range of things about being mentally or emotionally exhausted, being satisfied in their pastoral vocation, being confident in their ministry. Just a whole range of things that we looked at. A second category of risk was relationship risk. And I said this earlier, you know, do you have good, strong friendships? Are you feeling satisfied in your marital relationship and others? And then spiritual risk was a third area of risk that we looked at.
Spiritual risk. I need to know what spiritual risk is. Is that losing my faith?
Yeah, and the spiritual risk was a range of things that were including things like, do you practice spiritual disciplines on your own? How do you rate your own spiritual well-being? Has working in a church increased or decreased your own relationship with Christ? And so those were the kinds of things that we've looked at for spiritual risk. This is really under the category, are pastors using the same spiritual resources for themselves that they're recommending to their people? That kind of gets in this area of spiritual risk. And then kind of looking at the numbers, you know, a part of the way I would describe this is, for the most part, it was small numbers of people that were at high risk. 11% of all pastors were at high risk for burnout. 27%, 1 in 4, were at high risk of relational burnout. Only 5% were at high risk for spiritual risk. But when we looked at sort of medium levels of risk, that's where you started seeing a really huge increase. So 2 out of 5 pastors were at high or medium risk for burnout. Almost half were at high or medium risk for relationship burnout. And then 2 out of 3 were at high or medium risk for spiritual risk. So looking between all those numbers, it's like there's still, you know, tens of thousands of spiritual leaders, pastors who are in some type of risk. And even though the bottom line is many of these men and women are doing pretty well, there's still some areas in their lives, just like any human being, they're humans after all, who they need some help. They need us to come around, whether we're, a friend or a board member or an attender of their church, to try to, you know, help them in seeking this resilience through Jesus.
All right, friends, we're talking with David Kenneman. We're talking about the State of Pastors study, how today's faith leaders are navigating life and leadership in an age of complexity. You can find it all at Barna.com. David, before I let you go, and thank you for being so generous with your time, I want to ask about what you found in relationship to pastors and their influence in terms of cultural issues.
Well, this is one of the areas that we looked at that was, you know, sort of surprising but unsurprising, which is that a lot of people in America now believe that pastors have virtually nothing to say. They're sort of indifferent or even hostile to today's pastors. So only 1 out of 5 adults believe that pastors are very credible when it comes to the important issues of the day. And so one of the outcomes of this study, you know, we worked with Pepperdine University, a really great partner here in Southern California. They they were wonderful with their academic talent, and we looked at a whole range of different issues, including how pastors are leading themselves, it's some of the burnout stuff we've been talking about, how they're leading in the context of their congregations, the aging pastors, for example, the fact they're getting older and they're not necessarily leading with teams as much as they should. And this third area was how they're leading in a changing culture, a culture of complexity. And this is one of the mega themes of this research, that it's harder than ever to be a pastor because the society is more skeptical of Christianity and more skeptical of pastors as representatives of Christ. And so we talk a lot about in the research ways that the church could regain credibility, and that's through acts of service, that's through being confident in what Scripture teaches, but not just quoting the Bible, finding new ways of communicating about the authority of Scripture in our lives in a very self-centered age. And so, you know, there's no simple solutions to the questions of how do we lead spiritually, but our whole heart and the heart of Pepperdine University as our partner was to invest and create clarity about the problems and opportunities that today's pastors are facing, and then how do we step up and lead in this moment? How do we serve Jesus, especially when the headwinds are toughest? And that's where resilience, I think, is such an important point, right? Like, if we're going to work out, if we're going to go run a marathon, if the equivalent of leading spiritually is to have to run a marathon every day, then we got to be resilient to that task. And the hopeful part of this is many of these men and women who are leading today's pastors are doing just that.
So I'm wondering, David, if maybe as a parishioner, I need to be praying more for my pastor. I need to be encouraging my pastor in terms of his own friendships and encouraging him to develop deep relationships and deep friendships with those with whom he's in an accountable relationship. And then I need to be conversing with my pastor about the issues of the day. I need to be giving him an opportunity to talk through the biblical application or the application of biblical principles to the things that everyone is dealing with in everyday life and the cultural concerns of the day, really to almost encourage his equipping in the area of speaking to cultural issues. Because if parishioners aren't engaging pastors in those conversations, I'm imagining that it's hard for pastors to sort of find their way from the study and the pulpit into, you know, the diner conversations of the day.
Yeah, I think you said a lot of really great things about our importance of the church coming around and supporting today's pastors. I mean, I grew up in a pastor's home, and I remember a lot of really wonderful things that we received as a family in support from the support of people in the church. I also remember a lot of things that weren't always that comfortable, you know, being in a fishbowl and a lot of the challenges. And now, you know, that was 35 years ago, 43 now, you know, so growing up in a pastor's home, being in a church youth group, all the good things and the pressures that come from being a pastor's kid, the pressures are even more intense today. And so as a congregant, as a committed Jesus follower, absolutely having those conversations with your pastor, but also realizing that God has called that person to lead the church, and he or she may not lead it in the same way that you would lead it. And so not putting the wrong kinds of expectations on those leaders, supporting them. Maybe, you know, sometimes I think we find in the research that, you know, a lot of times parishioners put a lot of pressure on their pastors to speak and do the things that I want. I want you to tell me what to think about these things. And maybe we need classes and small groups and other, you know, host some people at your home to talk about these very complicated issues. Don't put all the pressure on the pastor. Support him or her in the work and in the calling. And at the same time, be receptive to, you know, maybe you being challenged. I think this is one of the key themes we see from the book Good Faith, is a lot of times Christians aren't willing themselves to be challenged, and so they end up thinking, you know, they've got it all right and that everyone else has got it all wrong. So it's really hard to pastor when you're pastoring, you know, a church of any size, and every single person in that congregation thinks they've got it all 100% nailed. So we've got to have the humility to realize that our pastors and our leaders are doing the very best they can, that we should be praying for them, praying for the reality of being in a post-Christian environment, and then asking Jesus to lead us with hope into that very uncertain future.
Well, I love that. And I would just like to say in closing that I know that there may be times that you look at what you do, and you may not see it as ministry, but I want to encourage you to recognize that it is. And so even though the context of ministry may be different than the context of ministry in which your dad has served, in the way that you equip the church to recognize its own failing to reach the next generation, I mean, what you taught us in You Lost Me was absolutely essential to the church in America waking up to its own failure to transmit the gospel to the next generation. The way you introduced us to the nuns in Unchristian and helped us to see what's going on with people who genuinely just walked away from the faith. It's not just that they walked away from church. And then in Good Faith, you challenge the church. You challenge Christians in ways that we need to be challenged. And now you're turning your attention in this study to pastors. And without those shepherds, you know, our congregations are literally wandering around as sheep, you know, as sheep without, you know, somebody to lead them. So thank you for the ministry that you're doing. Thank you for the way that you go about the ministry in which you are engaged. And know that we out here in the church appreciate it very, very much.
Carmen, that means so much to me. I really appreciate you spending the time to acknowledge all that. And, you know, there are days where I think I'd like to be a pastor. That seems like it'd be a lot easier than just being a researcher. Although I know for any pastors who are listening right now, you know, you laugh because it is a very tough calling. But it is our pleasure to serve men and women both in ministry, whether in a local church setting as pastors, you know, radio hosts and other leaders, and just thoughtful, engaged Christians. So, I mean, it really means a lot to me, and I really, really thank you for those comments.
Well, absolutely. All right, folks, it's David Kenneman. You can find everything we're talking about today at Barna.com. David, thanks for joining us on the Reconnect.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carmen.
Absolutely. All right, friends, this is the point in the show where we go below the fold. I grab a story from out there that doesn't look like it has anything to do with God and establish a hook in it for you to take it into conversations with other people and hopefully enable you to, turn the tide of a conversation. That's really sort of what we're going for here. So this one absolutely caught my eye, and let me just go ahead and tell you in advance, because as I start, you're going to think this is a sad, horrible story. Let me just go ahead and tell you it has a happy ending. So I pulled this off of Live Action News, and you can also grab it from the Christian Post as well. After 3 years of struggling to get pregnant, Kate and David Ogg were thrilled to learn that they were expecting twins. But at only 26 weeks, Kate went into preterm labor. And there's a video online which then chronicles the story. And suffice it to say that after giving birth, the couple learned that they had a daughter and a son. But the doctor then notified them that Jamie, their son, didn't make it, were his words. We've lost him. Kate instinctively grabbed her son, put him skin to skin against her chest, where he could hear her heartbeat and his body could be warmed by hers. She asked her husband David to take off his shirt and get in bed as well, so that Jamie would have flesh on flesh, as much body heat as possible from his parents. And that's the way they stayed, skin to skin, telling their son about his twin sister and talking to him. And then Kate says, and then he started to move. They quickly called in the midwives. They said Jamie is dying and that they needed to say their goodbyes. But these two parents and this newborn baby and the Lord our God had different plans. The newborn lifted his head, grabbed his father's finger, and opened his eyes. And so this was this happened 5 years ago. Jamie also has a four-year-old brother in addition to his twin sister. And let me tell you that when I read this story, the reason I wanted to lift it up to you was in part because medical people are not always exactly right. Sometimes moms and dads know best. But also, I have lived this experience. I was in Malawi working at a crisis nursery, and we got a call from a hospital, which was about 15 miles away, that there were two infant babies that were that were dying. They were newborns, and their mother had died in childbirth on the way to the hospital. And if we didn't come get them, the hospital was going to let them die because they didn't have the ability to care for them. So Mwawi, who is the name of the nurse at the facility, told Jan Hoagland and I to get in this truck, and literally the driver drove us straight through cornfields. Like, there was no attention to where the roads were. He drove a straight line from where we were to the hospital through these cornfields, through these villages, and we arrived to a quite horrific scene. These two newborn babies, who were certainly premature twins, their mother had died on the ox cart upon which her father had tried to get her to the hospital to deliver these babies unsuccessfully. He had taken his daughter's dead body away, and he had left these two babies to die at the hospital. They were still basically in all that comes with a newborn in terms of what was covering their little bodies, and they were cold to the touch. Mwawi immediately looked at Jan. As Mwawi was taking off her own shirt, she looked at Jan and said, "Take off your shirt." And Jan Hoagland, this 60-something-year-old woman from Hilton Head, very obediently took off her shirt while Mwawi bound this baby right to Jan's skin. It's called kangarooing. And let me tell you that those two babies lived. With the warmth of the human body against them, and with the love of God delighting in the gift of life, they lived. So it's called kangarooing. If you want to research it, you can do so online. It is a practice in Africa, and now it is also a practice in the West. All right, friends, that's all I got for you today. Have a great weekend. We'll see you right back here on Monday. Have a great weekend. God bless. Visit us online, reconnectwithcarmen.com.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.